Episode 416, this is Klaatu, and we're going to talk about GitText and other components of a Linux system. Yes, this is what we're doing lately. We've been going through every single package installed on Slackware Linux, but of course, because it's open source, it probably applies to your system as well. Everything you hear about on this show is quite probably available for your operating system, whether it's Linux, BSD, even Mac, or Windows can probably find this stuff. Well, definitely you can find GitText. So first, before we get into GitText, actually we're not going to talk about GitText. Sorry, we're going to talk about GitText tools. That there is a difference. This package is GitText tools, not just GitText. So before we get into that, let's talk about DeepGeek. DeepGeek has been experimenting around with immutable Debian, which doesn't exist, but he's trying to make it exist. And here's what he says. Wanted to send you a note to say that I've been experimenting with the concepts of an immutable OS under Debian. Interestingly enough, things are working, but the old geek nerd joke, in theory and practice are the same, still applies. The first thing I did was create a Chroot environment that ran Firefox. The Chroot management program, sChroot, is invaluable as it installs an infrastructure to run housekeeping scripts automatically. This is necessary as some facilities are created in the device hierarchy and thus are not present in the Chroot environment. For example, Firefox wants to use something called Linux Shared Memory, which needs to access /dev/shim, or shim, to do so. sChroot allows you to remount /dev/shm into the proper place within the Chroot environment, thus allowing the program to run. sChroot defaults to remounting the user's home directory into the Chroot environment, something I was looking to prevent. I prefer to bookmark the Chroot environment in my file manager to quick access to files in there. Using the fully featured ZFS file system to manage the Chroot environments is a dream come true. By keeping many snapshots during the process of building a Chroot environment, you can undo anything by issuing a rollback command to the file manager. Creating new Chroot environments is simply a matter of cloning a snapshot and takes the blink of an eye. All the while, ZFS replaces duplicate files with pointers under the hood so as not to waste disk space. Installing software is a matter of going into an environment as root and issuing install commands. Then, back in the main system, you copy the free desktop application file and icon from the Chroot environment into your local environment, in your home directory, that is, tilde /.local/share/applications, tilde /.local/share/icons, respectively. Modify the exec command to a sChroot command that runs the command in the Chroot environment for you, and you're off. I use App Image Launcher to detect the installation of app images and automagically add them to my personal menu. There is not a hit on performance that I can see, and shortly in the future, I plan to run both the Firefox LTS that Debian Security maintains, as well as the official Firefox Snap in the latest official release from Mozilla. He goes on. I installed my new Linux system in a new partition and used a program called Grub Customizer to name one New Linux and Old Linux. I did this to emulate the feature I read about in Silverblue, where there is a Grub entry for each Silverblue release, so you could go back if the latest and greatest just didn't work. Once I got ZFS up and running in the new system, I was floored to simply have to copy a few config files to my sChroot boot, to have sChroot boot my Firefox Chroot, which was present in the right place at my on my file system. I then realized that in the future, all my data sets that are really Chroot environments can be offloaded to a backup disk at end of life, and that I could go back and get into them whenever I needed to in the future. This is very exciting. What doesn't work? Anything that needs special libraries. Here's the example I found. Let's say you have an NVIDIA card that needs its proprietary drivers. You could remount the immutable systems /lib in your Chroot environment, but then updating the Chroot environment software without potentially overwriting the main system /lib hierarchy is problematic. So I do all the multimedia stuff in the main system. However, here's another rub. Let's say you want to have a programming or development environment in a Chroot environment. fine, as long as you don't need to use those drivers. If you want to do GPU programming to run some really fast math in those GPU processing cores, the Chroot option is out for you. So now I have the main system and two Chroot environments, and my old traditional system. I quickly fell into this routine. I update my main immutable system on the 1st, I update my Chroots and app images on the 10th, and I update my old system on the 20th of the month. This leaves me a rotating option of always having a way out if an update breaks a package for me. I'm glad I'm doing this, as it has opened up two new worlds for me. First, being able to run all my favorite Debian-supplied software while being able to co-install a new world of alien distro and third-party software. Secondly, a new level of stability that comes from being in even tighter control of updates than ever. Being able to go back if anything breaks, or even if some beloved piece of software gets discontinued by its developers' cheers. It is amazing. This is Klaatu again. That's amazing. So many thoughts and ideas come from this experiment. First of all, how cool is it? I'm going to forget half of my thoughts. But anyway, first of all, how cool is it that he was inspired to do this? I mean, this is what open source is all about, right? I mean, some people at Fedora decided to do some weird immutable OS thing, and they're doing it in a very specific way for whatever purposes they're doing it. I'm not entirely sure what those purposes are. Doesn't matter, right? They're doing it because they can. And then DeepGeek decides that's an idea for Debian. And so he takes his Debian install and transforms it into this sort of, he takes the idea and spins it into something different. Because he's not doing what Fedora is doing. Like, he is implementing this differently. But just as I said in the episode where I was talking about sort of the history of containers and so on, he's doing it in a predecessor, in the way of a predecessor. You know, he's doing it with Chroot. So in a way, he's almost reimagining Fedora Silverblue if it had happened 10 years earlier, kind of. So that's really cool. It's just neat to see inspiration have a ripple on effect that way. And as predicted, I've forgotten the other thoughts that this made me think about. But here's one thing that I do kind of wonder about this, and I'll have to ask DeepGeek for more information, but how much from the Chroot is he benefiting from, and how much is it just ZFS being ZFS? I can't quite extricate from his email here where the advantage of having it in a Chroot ends and the advantage of having all of this managed by ZFS begins. And so I'm just kind of wondering what the advantages are. And maybe that's something that I could... I mean, I would think that the advantage of the Chroot would be exactly what he said right here, where he says, at some point, I hope to run Firefox long-term support that Debian security maintains and the latest, you know, nightly build or whatever. No, the latest official release, he says, from Mozilla. So that to me would be the obvious use case for a Chroot. Like, I want to have applications kept separate from one another, and they're the same applications. So how do I do that? Well, Chroot sounds like a great option for that. But all the other stuff that he's talking about, like grub entries to go back to other versions and all this other stuff where he's talking about not remounting. He mentioned some other stuff about versioning and kind of backups and stuff like that. I wonder if that's, I mean, isn't that just ZFS? So, and maybe the two don't need to be separated. Maybe his point is that ZFS plus Chroot, you know, in many ways approximates Silverblue's immutable image plus Podman plus whatever container engine they're actually running underneath. Rocket, maybe? RKT? Cryo? I don't know what they're running. I forgot to look. Either way, this is a very cool experiment. It's amazing that it's actually sort of like working in a reasonable way. Oh, I remember it. So that was actually all of my thoughts are coming back to me. Now, what's really interesting to this about this to me in a sort of a personal level is that there is an email somewhere out there from like 2009, probably 2010, you know, where I am chatting with DeepGeek about this idea of having, yeah, like an immutable sort of image of your OS and then something else running on top of it. I don't remember what my interest on that was at the time, but I remember at the time, like, again, this is a long time ago, like 2010 or 2011 or something, I was saying to him that, or rather I was watching, you know, much of the world get very excited about virtual machines. And for some reason, and I don't exactly remember what it was, but for some reason I thought, well, I have no use for that, the virtual machine thing, but wouldn't it be interesting if you could have, like, just kind of the thing that drives your laptop or your computer, but at the time I had a laptop only, the thing that drives the laptop, and then sort of all of the stuff that you add to it would be very, very separate, like in a very, almost a physical way, like very separate from that. And I don't exactly remember, like, why. I do remember back then, it used to be sort of an interesting thought exercise for me. I used to be very interested in, like, what would it take to have an OS where at any moment you could just say, okay, I want to start back from a clean slate and really feel like it was a clean slate, you know? Sort of, I wanted that, I guess, the secure feeling that an immutable OS brings you, which I don't even know if today I can fully put that into words. Like, why does that matter? Like, who cares? It does not matter. But at the, you know, maybe because I came from a proprietary OS, and back in, you know, 2010, 2011, whatever, I would have only been using Linux for a mere, I don't know, 3 or 4 years or whatever. So 8, 9, 10, 11, yeah, maybe three or four years. And on a proprietary OS, you know, the cleanup process is a lot messier. And especially if you don't really understand how these things work anyway, then you don't understand that there's a separation between your user data and the actual OS, but that's not really super well sort of explained. So I don't know. I'm just wondering if there was something influencing that sort of fascination for me. But either way, whatever caused it, I remember talking to DeepGeek about this concept and asking him about it, and he had some ideas, and I never got around to really playing around with any of those ideas. But I feel like in a really, really weird way, 10 years later or whatever it is, we've kind of circled back around to that. I don't even know if he remembers this, but I do. And in a weird way, we've circled around to this again with really, like, implementable solutions. Like, here's exactly how that would work. Like, here's the immutable OS. Here's where you can install stuff and have it separate from your system for whatever reason, like whatever reason that might be. And he has several good reasons here. You know, either it's because you might want to run two different versions of the same application, or because there's some kind of application that's been abandoned or whatever, and you need to put it into a known environment. Well, there you go. That's how you do that. So, yeah, really, really cool. Very exciting. And I think that the experiments that he's done are frankly they're staggering. They're mind blowing. And when he emailed me, maybe, you know, 3 months ago or whatever, whenever I did the first Silver Blue episode, and said, "Gee, I wonder how this would work on Debian." Last thing in the world I imagined to get from him via email was that he has done it, that it's been implemented, and hey, it's going pretty well. So that's just amazing. On to the next email. This one is from Kevin, friend of the show. You've probably heard this name mentioned before. Actually, maybe I haven't said his name. I mean, I know I've said his name once or twice, but early on I wasn't clear on whether I was supposed to say his name, so I never said his name. But now I can say it. He's given me permission. It's Kevin. It's Kevin. Kevin has released AOS 3.1, which he also says is technically 46 beta. AOS is a really cool little project. It is, I'm going to call it, for lack of a better term, maybe a Slackware spin, by which I mean it's Slackware with packages pulled as required from Slackware repositories and Slack build and anything that Slack PKG Plus supports. And it installs a base desktop similar to what you'd expect on any OS with just enough tools to manage your system, play your music, your videos, manage fonts and partitions graphically, gives you a default browser, and I think that's about it. And then after installation, you log in as root, you set up a password, and use a web-driven application to set up your system. So it is designed to be Slackware, really, for just a regular user, if we could say that. I mean, I know that one might want to say, well, Slackware is for a regular user. Like, anybody can use Slackware. And it's true, anybody can. And I encourage anybody to use Slackware. But you know the situation. You know, when you've got someone and you're like, look, you're interested in Linux and you want to try something, but I got to be honest with you, the system I know best is Slackware. So here's Slackware on a disk. Best of luck. I mean, that's kind of crazy. So it is nice, and I'm speaking from experience here, to have like a system that's a little bit easier to just kind of slide right into. Slackware sometimes, there is a learning curve, not sometimes. There is a learning curve to Slackware. It boots to a text prompt, and you have to set things up. It can be a little bit of a learning curve. Something that gives you a bunch of sort of safe defaults from the start is really nice. I used to really enjoy ZenWalk or Salix OS. I still enjoy Porteus. And yeah, I haven't checked in with really ZenWalk or Salix lately. I'm assuming they're doing fine. But AOS is a really nice project, sort of, you know, in that direction. Like, it's a contribution towards that same kind of experience. If you're interested in that sort of thing, try it out. Just look up AOS. Actually, you don't have to look it up. Just go to sourceforge.net/projects/AllegianceOS. AllegianceOS. AllegianceOS. 3.1, that's the latest and greatest as of this recording, like right now, which is July 6th is when I'm recording this. It's a relatively small download, too. It's like only 1 gig, so that's a lot smaller than the default Slackware download, which is another nice kind of bonus here, that there's such a limited scope that you'd have to actually install or download less, which is quite nice. I mean, sometimes. I mean, it depends on if you don't care about bandwidth and disk space, then I guess it doesn't really matter. But it's a good one. You should check it out. Take a look at it. And right now it is based on sort of a, you know, some kind of unholy amalgamation of 14.2 plus current. So that's where we are in Slackware land right now. There's really no way around that. And I kind of address that on occasion here because I'm stepping through Slackware, but I mean, I'm stepping through 14.2 packages, just kind of knowing that 15 is around the corner and agreeing mutually with you, dear listener, that 14.2 and 15 aren't really going to be that different. So if we miss a package here or there or cover a package that gets dropped from 15, it doesn't matter that much. It's all okay. Yeah, so AOS, it's a good one, Allegiance OS. And then, it looks like, I don't know, from a cursory look through the internet, it looks like ZenWalk and Salix OS are still things that happen. So that's kind of cool. It's kind of neat. I should check them out sometime. Maybe I will after 15.0 comes out and everyone's rebased. So that's everything. So let's talk about Git Text Tools. Wait, should we talk about Git Text Tools, or should we take a coffee break? Let's take a quick coffee break. Let's do that, and then we'll come back and talk about Git Text Tools. Sound like a plan? Git Text Tools is a support package for another package called Git Text. Git Text Tools is useful for authors and maintainers of internationalized software or for anyone compiling programs that use the Git Text functions. This package provides the needed tools and library functions for the handling of messages in different languages. Some other GNU packages use the Git Text program included in this package to internationalize the messages given by shell scripts. It's been ages since I talked about Git Text. So far, I can't even find it in my show notes. That would have been like pre-2018. Like literally, I have instances in show notes on the webpage, GNUWorldOrder.info, back to January of 2018, and I was talking about Adder and GNU Core Utils and Gawk, InitTab, Getty, Agetty, things like that, but no Git Text. I don't see Git Text anywhere. Maybe that would have been around the time of Git Text, but I can't find that specifically in the show notes. So I don't even know what episode to refer you to. It's possible that I kind of skimmed over Git Text. I don't remember that far back how specific I was being. Like sometimes I feel like I just kind of quickly sort of summarized things, which I still do, but I don't remember talking about Git Text, in other words. And so I kind of feel like possibly I kind of briefly mentioned its purpose and then moved on. Which to some degree, I guess I'll probably do with some of these Git text tools. I haven't necessarily used them at any great length myself, and so the useful things that I can say about it are limited. But we might as well start from... let's start from the beginning. Now I'm not so sure, because I realize some of these tools, out of context, are a little bit difficult to explain, or possibly not useful to explain. So let's not start from the beginning. Let's start from a point of figuring out how to use Git Text. This is Git Text, like a lot of sort of GCC and G++ and GDB, a lot of the default documentation you're going to run across for this stuff assumes that you're writing in C, and I write nothing in C. Even when I'm doing something C-like, it's C++. It's not C. So that's a little bit, I feel like it's a little bit of an overkill, to be honest, is how I feel about it. Because I feel like learning to do it the way that it's documented, if you're not writing C, then that doesn't really help much at all. Now, luckily, I do write shell scripts quite a lot, and Git Text does support shell scripts, not necessarily in an overt way. They sort of casually mention it here and there in the documentation, but they really, from what I can tell, they focus on C. But you can get there in the end. You can get to where you need to be. Now, a lot of these tools make some of these steps that I'll go over initially automated, so that you don't have to do them as manually as I'm going to do right now. So the first thing I'm going to do is find a script that requires translation. And I might as well use the thing that I use all the time that I've written, my favorite thing that I've ever written, I think, is Trashy. You may have heard me mention it before. It is a trash command for your terminal. So you don't use rm, because rm is irrecoverable. Trash, however, or Trashy, sends a file to your freedesktop.org trash can, and then you can restore it later on. It's a very useful command. I highly recommend it. If you don't use it, then use some other trash command. I think there's one other one out there for a terminal. I think it's written in Python. It's well worth looking into. Use it instead of rm. Anyway, stop me before I get too far down that path. I'm just urging you to use trash. But Trashy is not translated into lots of different languages, so it does need to get translated at some point. And the way that I would do that is I would open up Trashy, which is in bin Trashy, and I would scroll to the bottom of the little license header, and then I would add these three lines. Export text domain, all capitals, equals Trashy. Export text domain dir, again, all capitalized, equals slash user share locale. And I know that it's user share locale because I can look in user share and discover that there is indeed a locale directory. Now, I don't know for sure that that's the case on every system. I don't think that it changes, but just be aware that it could be, for instance, in like user local share locale. There may be one in that location. So it just depends on how you set up your system. But on Slackware, the default location for this directory is user share locale. And then the final line of this little incantation to get git text working with my script is dot space git text dot sh. And you might think, well, where is git text dot h? Where does that exist? It's in user bin. Believe it or not, /user/bin/gittext.sh, it's there. So all we're doing is kind of bringing it into Trashy. Okay, so I think that's all I need to do for that. Well, not technically, so I might as well leave that open for a moment. So text domain is a variable that gittext wants to see, and it wants to see sort of the namespace of what it's dealing with, and so we're calling that namespace Trashy. Text domain dir contains the path to your localization directory. Now this gittext.sh script that we're importing into Trashy, it's going to, we can use it to echo strings to sort of intercede for us when we're echoing strings to our user. So for instance, currently if you execute the command trash and you have nothing in your trash can, in your system trash, you get the message, you have no files in trash. So I'm going to do a search for you have no, here we are. So on line 43 of this script, well, it's 43 now because I inserted those lines at the top of my script. I've got echo, you have no files in trash. And that's a condition if the check for emptiness returns true. Technically, if a check returns nothing, then it echoes, you have no files in trash. That's close to what we need, but it's a little bit different. And see, there's a similar mechanism that you would use. You would define macros and things like that within your code. In Bash, instead of saying echo, you have no files in trash, I'm going to do echo, $ get text, space, quote, you have no files in trash, dot quote, close parentheses, and then I'm going to do a semicolon echo, because there's no new line character. The get text doesn't put the new line character in there, so for me, so I'm going to add an extra echo at the end of that initial echo, just to make sure that I get my prompt cleanly on a new line. Okay, so the thing is here, the point is that you'll go through your script and you'll find all your echo statements or printf statements or whatever you're using, you'll find those, and instead of echoing the string in your native language that you've written or whatever language you're using, instead of just echoing that, you're going to echo the results of git text, you have no files in trash. Okay, I'm just going to do that to that one string just to keep this simple. But in real life, I would go through my code, refactor it such that all echoes don't echo raw text. They echo the results of git text, some text, and that's it. Git text, of course, that command, git text, that's a function in the gittext.sh script in user bin that we imported into the script. Okay, so now you've got your script set up for the ability to have its strings abstracted away, like its natural language strings abstracted away from the code itself. So I'm going to, actually, I think we are going to use, yeah, we're going to use now a command that will do that for us. And this is from the package that we're supposed to be talking about right now. So that works out really nicely. This is the second, no, it is the last command. It's the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 18th command in the package, in the git text tools package. So this is the first time we're actually using this tools package. Gittext.sh came along with git text, so we weren't using the tools then. But now we're using one of the tools provided from the gittext-tools, and that is called xgittext. X having nothing to do with x11, xorg, whatever. It's I assume it's sort of a fancy way of saying extract. I think that's probably what it's a reference to. So it's xgittext. In this case, I'm going to do dash dash language shell, because that's the language I'm doing. And then I think I better look up the man page. Hold on. I think it's dash dash output. It is. Dash dash output, I'm going to do trashy dot pot. So pot is the portable translation or something like that. I think it's portable object template is what it is. Sorry, nothing having to do with translation. It's portable object template. And then the input file that I want this X get text thing to look at, make sure it's saved and closed. It is bin/trashy. Okay, so it's done. So now if I look in trashy.pot, which does exist, I get what looks like a bunch of garbage, to be honest. There's a bunch of stuff that it did not detect. So it says the first line is some descriptive title. It's not very useful, so I'm going to put trashy translation template. Copyright year, the package is copyright holder. Yeah, so it didn't. I don't know why it doesn't pick up this stuff. I've got auto tools in the project. Everything to me feels like it should be available, especially like first author email address year. Like, I know I've got the author's name in configure.ac, but anyway, it isn't, and it's not there, and that's fine. So eventually you get down to line 20 of this thing, and it's bin trashy line 43. It specifies that in a little comment here. And then it says message ID, quote, you have no files in trash, dot quote. And then message string, quote, quote. So what it has done is it has extracted the one thing that I've prepped for git text. And that's line 43. It's extracted the part of that line that git text was meant to analyze, and it has put it into this .pot file. And were I going to engage in a full translation of my little utility, I would, of course, first I would prep the trashy script with a bunch of git text statements instead of echo statements, or echo git text statements, really, instead of just echo statements. And then I would extract them all, dump them into a .pot template, and then from that .pot, I could create separate translations of each message ID in some other language. And of course, ideally, I could then post that onto some magical social coding website, and people would flock to my repository to contribute their translations. That's what would happen, ideally. I'll just say that. And that's git text's workflow, at least for a bash script. It is not all that different for a C project or a C++ project. Git text, that's sort of how it works. Now there's a bunch of like other stuff that you can do. You can merge files with partial translations. You can manipulate different message IDs and look at different message IDs and stuff like that. And that is what these git text tools are meant to assist with. So let's take a look at some of those. I'm not gonna need that trashy anymore. Let's go into hello, maybe. Okay, so here's the GNU hello project, and it looks like there's already a PO structure in here, which is actually, that's kind of nice. And in fact, if you look in GNU hello, you'll see exactly the correct output, like, or the a template properly filled out. So I just happened to, well, actually, you know what, I'm going to do a different one, because Gaelic I cannot even pretend to pronounce. So let's do this. Okay, here we go. So here's the French one, maintained by David Prevost, Michel Robitaille. I don't know how to say that. Hello, and then it says, message ID, hello world. Message string, bonjour le monde. Message ID, hello world, bonjour le monde. That's another one. Line 103, extra operand, percent S, / N. Message string, apparature supplémentaire, percent S, / N. And so on. So you get to see the translation exactly as it would occur in a translation file. And those are all in the PO folder. So that's a great thing to sort of to look at, probably. And it'll be interesting to see what happens here, because the first tool that we're going to look at is AutoPoint. A-U-T-O, AutoPoint, P-O-I-N-T. And let's see what it says it does. It says it copies the standard Git text infrastructure into a source package. So if I feel like it's going to fail right now because there's already the infrastructure, but I'm going to do it anyway. AutoPoint says file build aux config.rpath has been locally modified. Yeah, so it's detecting that things that things already exist. So I'm going to do a --- force just to make it happen. And what it does, it's copying files in for configuration help, for M4 scripts, or macros rather. We've encountered the M4 macro system back when we were talking about AutoTools and AutoConf and AutoReconf and AutoMake, stuff like that. And then a couple of PO files, including a makevars.template. And makevars.template is a pretty important file that I think we're going to actually touch on momentarily, possibly right now, if there's nothing else to say about AutoPoint. I don't really feel like there is. It is kind of what it is. It copies important Git text support files into a source package. I happen to know that it fails if there's not a proper AutoTools infrastructure already. So for instance, if you're missing a configure.ac, it won't know what to do, or it will refuse to do what it would normally do. I don't know if that's a thing that it requires or if it's just a thing that it's doing for your own safety. Very similar to this is a tool called gettextize, gettextize, gettextize. And that, it sets up the infrastructure and gives you some prompts as to what to do next. Let's see what it claims to do. According to its info page, it says that it's a program. It's an interactive tool. That's a little bit misleading. It's an interactive tool that helps the maintainer of a package internationalize through GNU GitText. It is used for two purposes: as a wizard when a package is modified to use GitText for the first time, and as a migration tool for when you're upgrading. I don't know that I accept this as a wizard, really. I'm not too sure about whether I would call it a wizard myself at all, but maybe I'm just not using it right. Now it's got me curious, seeing that it claims to be a wizard. No, I'm going to say that this isn't a wizard. Because right here in 13.4.5, configure AC or configure.in, this is the source from which AutoConf generates the configure script. Declare the package and version. This is done by a set of lines like these. Package equals gettext, version equals blah. AC define unquoted package. AC define unquoted version. AC subst packet, AC subst version. Or if you're using automake, am underscore init, automake gettext, and then version. So, of course, gettext would be your trashy in this example, I guess. Or hello, whatever we're in. There's a lot of manual stuff that you actually have to do, but maybe, I don't know, maybe if I knew something that they're not telling me, or that I'm not being patient enough to get to, there would be some magical automation that I've never seen before. Anyway, I'm going to run gettextize right now, and it says you can't do that. Infrastructure already exists, but you can use -F to force it. So we'll do that. So at first it feels and sounds and sort of acts pretty much like AutoPoint. It copies a file called about-nls, copies a file build-aux config-rpath. It doesn't copy the intl directory. It does copy some PO-related files, some more M4 scripts, That was the part I was thinking was a little bit like Auto Point. And yeah, it does that. Make vars template. And then it tells you 6 different steps that you have to take to sort of finish this process, more or less. Press return to acknowledge the previous paragraphs. And, well, I guess it's okay. So 3 paragraphs here. There's 6 paragraphs if you're starting from a completely empty or no translation project. But it tells you to please update PO make vars so that it defines all the variables mentioned in PO make vars dot template. So if I didn't have makevars already in GNU Hello, it would be telling me to make a file called makevars based on makevars.template. And makevars.template is a very well commented folder. It tells you things like, this is the copyright holder that gets inserted into the header of the domain.pot file. Set this, see, that's what I was looking for right there. That's the auto detection I was looking for. So copyright holder equals, and then an example, this tells it whether to prepin GNU in front of the package name. This is the email address or URL to send bugs to, and so on. So it's got a bunch of things, and it tells you exactly like what the valid values are and what the defaults are, and generally why you would choose one over the other. It's a really well commented file. There were a couple of things that I left not quite understanding when I was doing this, but generally it's nicely explained. So that's the makevars template, and then you create just a file called makevars in your PO directory. And then it tells you to run aclocal to generate your aclocal.m4 the necessary m4 files. If some of it already exists, it might be something different, like aclocal -im4 if you don't need the whole structure. And then it'll tell you, you know, if required, well, I think it would always, I would imagine it would always be required to then run autoconf to regenerate your configure file, your configure script, because now there's new stuff that your system needs to look at. It says you also might want to copy the convenience header file gettext.h from user share gettext into your package. And there's another one sometimes you'll see to grab config.guess and config.maybe sub, I think, which are files, and it gives you the URL. It's very easy. I mean, I don't mean to say it's not a wizard. I guess just when I see that it's a wizard, I think it would be doing that stuff for me. But yeah, it's very clear. It tells you pretty much exactly what to do, and then you're kind of on your own. And that's kind of where it gets scary. So this is the boilerplate text, you know, this is the infrastructure stuff, but it doesn't step you through like what to do after you have all that stuff. And that admittedly can be a little bit difficult to know what to do. I mean, it's just kind of tough to know where to go once that infrastructure exists. Although now you kind of do know, because we've gone through the shell script version of it, and certainly the C version of all that is pretty well documented in the gettext documentation on gnu.org/software/gettext. Okay, let's look at the next tool called message attrib. This is a sort of a filter command for you to look at a message catalog, as they call it, which is a PO file, and sort of filter out what information by attribute. So for instance, if we look at message, if we do message attrib --untranslated and then point it at PO/FR for French.PO, then it spits out the results of the FR.PO file, but instead of just catting the whole thing, I mean, the whole thing is like if I did a line count of PO/FR.PO, so WC space -L PO/FR.PO, it's 302 lines, but message attrib spits out just 25 lines, and what it is spitting out is the header information, and then the one message ID in this thing that has not been translated into French. As you can imagine, that's a very useful kind of, that's really useful information when there's a high likelihood that people are going to be coming to your project, to the PO directory of a project, in order to help translate. So being able to zero in quickly on untranslated things is quite useful. Now, there are a lot of other options. It's not just untranslated, but I think you get the idea. That's essentially that's what that does, is it looks at different attributes of message catalogs and figures out, you know, and filters it out for you. So it's quite useful. Like a little database function almost. Message cat combines several message catalogs. I don't really have a good example of this, but I think it's relatively easy to figure out what that means. You take two PO files, maybe two people have been working on translations separately or something, you combine them together. Or, I mean, you could just use it as essentially an intelligent cat command, too. I mean, if that's all you wanted to do. So if I wanted to do message cat fr.po, then I do get the file concatenated out into my terminal with a bunch of color highlighting, and it's kind of maybe possibly easier to read the important parts, you know, separate important parts from the less important parts and so on. Next up is message CMP. That is to compare message catalogs. I think you're getting kind of the feel for this package, this utility package. Compare message catalog and template. Compare two uniformstyle.po files to check that both contain the same set of message ID strings. That ought to work. Let's do message comp po fr.po and po galig.po, and it has found several errors, actually. Line 29 of the French one needs to be reviewed by the translator. 45, messages untranslated. 78 should be reviewed by translator. 121 should be reviewed by translator, and so on. So really, really useful stuff here. You know, flags being raised, tasks essentially being generated. Very cool stuff, as you can see. Message comm. This is finding messages which are common to two or more of the specified files. Now, I'll admit this has not been working for me, and I'm not exactly sure why not, or maybe I'm getting the use case confused. It sounds to me like the use case would be, I want to make sure that the messages that I believe are in both, you know, all translatable files, or all PO files, are there. So I would think that either sort of like a unique, or a sort and a unique, I would think that you would see output listing either all the common things or all the things that are not common. And what I'm getting instead is output from one file and not another file, and no indication that there's any sort of match between the two. It seems to me like when I provide input, when I provide input to this command for two files, it only pays attention to one. So it kind of gives a nod to that concept, but this is very confusing. So in the man page or the info page, it's the same thing. There's no dedicated info page. So I'm going to look at the man one because that's actually color coded. So in the man page, it says match two message catalogs. In the synopsis, it says message comm option input file. Those are both singular words, not options, not input files. And then in the description, it says find messages which are common to two or more of the specified PO files, plural. Says some other stuff, and then it says translations, comments, and extracted comments are preserved, but only from the first PO file to define them. File positions from all PO files will be accumulated. Mandatory arguments too long. Yeah, it doesn't matter. And then it says input file location, input file, singular, dot, dot, dot. And then it says input files, plural. So confused as to what exactly they want. But I'm pretty sure what they're trying to say is that they want two files. They want one PO file and another. And then this is going to find the common messages contained in both. There are some options here, as there often are. One is dash dash no dash location. Do not write hash colon file name colon line. Or dash dash add location. Or for short, dash in. Dash in? Shouldn't it be dash like A for add? Dash A is available. It's not being used by another option. They just decided to make add location dash in, which to me looks like a negation of something. That's weird. I would think dash in would be no location, wouldn't you? Dash dash add location would reduce to maybe a dash A, or maybe if that was taken, maybe a dash L. If that was taken, maybe a dash C, maybe? I mean, C says config to me, but, you know, whatever. I don't know, that's weird. Okay, so anyway, here's what we got. So I can do a message com, and then we'll just leave out all options, and we'll do po slash ga dot po space po slash he dot po. And I get stuff back that looks very Gaelic to me. Yeah, the whole thing looks like it's from the Gaelic file to me. I'm not seeing anything that doesn't look Gaelic to me. No, I'm pretty sure that's all. That's all from one file. And it did say that it would only be kept from the first file to define them. So I guess what they're maybe telling me is that these two files are exactly the same. And so I'm seeing the output of the first one. That seems like a really weird way to tell me that. But if I do indeed swap the positions of Gaelic with Hebrew, in this case he.po, then all the output is Hebrew. Very, very discernibly Hebrew. I think that's Hebrew. It's some language that does not use the alphabet that I'm familiar with. So I could do the same thing with fr, and those are all French. So I don't know, maybe it's just telling me, I guess the test here would be to go in and find a string, nothing happens here. Okay, I'm going to delete that. So now that PO file does not contain a message, and I see no mention that of that. But maybe the thing that they're telling us is that this is a common thing. Like, these are the common strings. That seems odd to me, because to me, I would think that the workflow would have been, well, I need to find out what's missing, but there must be a workflow where this information is very useful, because otherwise I don't see the use. So there must be a use for this. I mean, someone didn't develop this program because it spits out useless information, obviously. So maybe it is working, is the short story. It's just, I don't know, it feels a little bit strange. No, it's all coming together now. So now, okay, so you want to confirm that all the messages you think should be in a file are in a in both files. So you put your native tongue first on the command, in the command syntax. And that way you're seeing something that you recognize. And I guess by the fact that it is there, you are getting confirmation that yes, it was found in the other file. And if one is missing, then you know, hey, there's one missing. But I guess you that's the weird part for me. Because how do you remember what all of the things are? But maybe there's something else for that. Maybe there's some other tool for that, like the message compare. Okay, message conv is next, and it is a character set conversion for a message catalog. I've never had to use this. This seems to be done automatically by most of the Git text tools that I've encountered so far, but the principle is pretty much the same as anything like iconv or any... What was that other one that we just talked about, I think, in the Java program or something? I think it was gcc-java. There was something for conversion. So that's what that is. That's message conv. Not a big deal. Message en creates an English translation catalog. The input file is the last created English PO file or a PO template file, which is important, right? Because that's what we did with X get text, and then it creates the English.po file. So I'm going to push D back to trashy really quick, and I'm going to do message en trashy.pot, and it, well, actually that's not very useful what it just did. Let's find out what I thought for sure that, because the, oh no, it says, okay, output, you need to define the output. I thought it would do that automatically, but apparently not. So dash dash output, and then we could do trashy.po, and then we look at trashy.po, and sure enough, there's my little fledgling PO file. Not a whole lot to look at right now, but that would be the en version. I guess that I wouldn't call it trashy.po. I would call it en.po, and then I would have en.po, and I could use it to, you know, people could use it to generate different PO files for their language. All right, let's look at message exec. This is a process translation of message catalog. It applies a command to all translations of a translation catalog. The command can be any program that reads a translation from standard input. It is invoked once for each translation. Its output becomes message exec's output. So this is a sort of a tunnel application, so that if you need to execute some command on all of your PO files, this would be the thing to do it with. I could imagine maybe sed being a candidate for that. Similar to this command is message filter. Message filter allows you to invoke a filter script, or a filter, well, I guess it would probably be a script, and then it executes that script or that command across all of the messages. So for instance, the syntax is message filter, whatever options, and then the filter, and then any filter options as required. And the filter can be any program that reads a translation from standard in and writes a modified translation to standard out. And of course, you can specify your output locations if you don't want it to just be written back out to standard out itself, but that's what that does. So for instance, if you had some other message tool that you wanted to run against a bunch of files, you could use message filter and then place that command as your filter, and it would then process it on each message. Message format is a little application that compiles, sort of, your PO file into a binary format. I think that's basically all it does. Message format. Yeah, it compiles message catalog to binary format. And again, message catalog, that's a .po file. It understands a couple of different formats. That's kind of cool. And yeah, it has some options to override, but it's pretty easy to demonstrate, if not necessarily intuitive. Well, I guess it's kind of intuitive. Anyway, what you do is you do msgfmt and then point it at a PO file. So I'll point it at the Gaelic PO file, message format ga.po, do an ls, and it looks like it has dumped all of that information into a messages.mo file. And if I do a file on messages.mo, it says that it is a GNU message catalog, little Indian, revision 0.0, 12 messages, project ID version, hello 2.3-h-help, and then some stuff in Gaelic. So that's kind of cool. It has quite a lot of knowledge about itself, and it is a binary file, so that can be probably utilized pretty quickly by the system compared to a big sort of plain text file. The Gaelic PO file is 7.5k, and the messages.mo is a mere 1.4k. So quite a difference in size there. I mean, it's only kilobytes, so they're small, but still, you know, it adds up. Okay, next command, you can almost guess what it does. It's called message grep, and it, sure enough, if you look at the info page, message grep pattern matching on message catalog. Well, this is an unfortunate name, in my opinion. I feel like it's a little bit misleading, but, I mean, it is sort of accurate anyway. But the name makes me think that all I'd have to do is type in message grep and then the string that I'm searching for. So I'm going to just type in files and then the file that I want to search, which is trashy.pot. And it says message grep, at most one input file is allowed. Okay, well, that's surprising. So let's go back into the man page and see what I'm doing wrong. Message grep option input file. Okay, well, so you keep reading and eventually you'll get to the point where it says there's a message selection syntax. And there are a couple of different options here. There's dash capital N for your source file, dash capital M for your domain name, dash capital J for your message ctext pattern, dash capital K for message ID pattern. Message ID pattern sounds good. So, and it says dash K for message ID pattern, so presumably that's what we would want to use. It says message ID dash pattern or message string pattern or comment pattern or extracted comment pattern syntax is dash E or dash F. I don't see where that is decoded for me, but apparently dash E, oh, regular expression, oh, extended regular expressions if dash E is given, or fixed string if dash F is given. Okay, there we go. That's what we needed. Message grep, dash capital K for the message ID, right? And then files, I guess. And then dash capital F, I think is what it said, for fixed string. This is not super intuitive. Trashy.pot, at most one input file is allowed. Okay, it maybe wants, so what it wants maybe is message grep dash capital K dash capital F, and then the word files. Trashy.pot, at the most one input file is allowed. Okay, dash capital K dash capital F, how about files in single quotes, at most one input file is allowed. So this is not working out for me as written, and I'm not 100% sure why. So let's try it as an extended regex instead. So that's capital E, at most one input file is allowed. Man message grep again. It does say that for message ID pattern, the syntax is dash capital E pipe dash capital F close bracket and then bracket dash E lowercase pattern or dash F file. Okay, so maybe what it's telling me is that I'm supposed to use the lowercase e unless it is extended, in which case I use the lowercase, the capital E. So now I'm going to do message grep dash capital K dash lowercase e quote files close quote trashy pot. Message grep present car set. Car set is not a portable encoding name. All right. So I guess there's something in this .pot file that isn't set correctly. Content type is car set. I'm assuming that I need to set that to UTF-8. Thanks for nothing, get textize. Message grep dash K dash E files trashy pot. There we go, finally it has worked. It spits out the header and then it spits out the matching message on line 43, which is you have no files in trash. That was horribly documented. I just wanted I wanted to go through the steps that it takes to decode the way that that is expressed in the man page. You read that man page, message grep, and you tell me that you could have gotten that on the first try. Well, anyway, time is fleeting, and we have a couple of more tools to go, so we can't dwell on that. Message init, M-S-G-I-N-I-T. This initializes a message catalog. So that creates a new PO file, initializing the meta information with values from the user's environment. So this is the tool that I would have thought that that I would have gotten from GetTextize, because this is an interesting one. You go to a tool that has a directory of code that's got the automake or the auto tools infrastructure set up, message init, and it takes you through the steps of setting up a reasonable file. So the first thing it says is that your message should contain an email address, and then it presents you with email addresses that it knows you use. I believe it took that from GNU PG, because that's where those email addresses to me look familiar, but it could be from somewhere else, I'm not sure. And then it runs essentially GetTextize. It still doesn't fill in like quite as much as I would have thought, but it does, it has some stuff in there, like it's got my email address, it's got my first name, it's got the date for the creation, pot creation date, PO creation date, things like that, the language team, like the default language set, the character set, so you're not going to run into car set errors and so on. So that's a useful one. I don't know why message init exists, or rather, I don't know why GetTextize exists if message init exists, unless, of course, message init calls GetTextize, which is quite possible. But I don't think I would have left GetTextize sort of as its own thing, to be honest. I just, I don't know. I mean, I guess you kind of have to. It's there. Maybe in the man page of GetTextize, I would say, this tool is intended to be run through message init, something like that. All right, next one is message merge. It merges message catalogs. It's you know, sort of in that same vein of compare and common and so on, but this just, and concatenate, this purely merges two message catalogs. Not a whole lot to say about that, I don't think. Message unformat. Well, we know what message format does, and if you're guessing that unformat does the opposite, that's correct. It decompiles messages that were in the binary format back out into PO files. And that's, you know, you would just execute that on messages.mo, and then you would get the PO files out of them. It's pretty cool. Message unique. It's kind of the inverse of message, message common. It unifies duplicated translations in a message catalog. So you can run message unique against, again, it expresses things singularly, even though it actually means plural, but you can use it to find messages that exist only in one message catalog. Yeah. Okay. And finally, the penultimate command in this package is recode-sr-latin, and that converts Serbian text from Cyrillic to Latin script. It's magic to me. I don't understand how that works. It's absolute magic. I don't have anything to test that against, but it says the man page is like, you know, maybe 25 lines at the most. It's straight and to the point. It is going to convert the Serbian text from the Cyrillic alphabet to the Latin alphabet, and that is what, well, it says Cyrillic to Latin script. I guess that means just alphabet, right? Yeah, that would be the alphabet. I think, is the alphabet the same as a character set? Not necessarily, I guess. Anyway, that's what it does. It converts from Serbian to Latin scripts. Pretty cool. And then the final command you'll be happy to know we've already covered. It is xgit text, and that's the thing that extracted. Actually, I guess we could look at the man page real quick. Xgit text extracts git text strings from source. And that is what it does. That's its job. It is going to take messages that are being piped through the git text infrastructure, put them into a message catalog file so that you, or a template rather, so that you and your translators can generate translation files from those. We've seen it in action. We've seen how it works. Works well. That's it. That's all. That's everything. I haven't gone through, you know, I've gone through these tools, experimenting around with them as I work on translating Trashy, but I haven't finished that process, you know, in the week that I've had to mess around with this stuff. So I haven't sort of gotten through a successful compile session with all of this. So I haven't actually seen I haven't generated a working example of all of this. That can be a good topic for the future. Once it's finished, I'll have to come back to it and sort of demonstrate how it actually all works. I did try to do like sort of a really quick partial translation and then compile it, but something was up with my PO directory, I think, because it couldn't find, I think, a make file or something within the PO directory, which didn't make a whole lot of sense to me because I didn't create the PO directory in the first place. I had git textize do that for me. So I'm not really sure what was sort of missing from the infrastructure, but it seemed to be missing something, and it was non-trivial to figure out what was wrong. And so I figured it would be better to abandon my partial translation and just do the translation, get that done, and then worry about how to bring it all back around into a compilable, or, you know, like a redistributable translated actual script that people could run. And it being, again, a shell script that I'm doing this on is giving me, it's causing a couple of interesting problems that most users don't seem to be, it's not exactly the most common purpose for this tool, as far as I can tell. It really seems to be, people kind of expect you to be actually literally compiling code, and that's just not what I'm doing. So a little bit different, a little bit unique. Just trying to do more research on getting that to work. And like I say, future episode, maybe I'll get that done. But that's everything. That's the Git Text Tools package from Slackware. Now you know every single executable binary in the package, and who knows, maybe you'll use it sometime. Maybe not, but now you know it exists. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening. My name's Klaatu. You can reach me anytime over email with feedback or comments, tips, or just to say hi. My email address is klaatu@slackermedia.info. You can also reach me on the Mastodon network, not Klaatu, at mastodon.xyz. The show's intro and outro music is by Fat Chance Lester. You can find their music on bandcamp.com or on gnuworldorder.info. In the archive, you'll find a music directory containing the album from which this music has been extracted. Until next time, thanks for listening and keep the source open.
Message, your answering machine sounds weird. I can't even understand what's said, so I'm hoping you get this. This is Katie. Just give me a call. I think I've got a solution.